Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis of what's going on in the news media these days, with some veteran journalists offering you some insight into ethical decision making and some of the ups and downs of news coverage. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now publishing The Upstate American on Substack, and I am here with three colleagues. Two other former editors, Judy Patrick, who was the editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, and Barbara Lombardo, who was editor of the Saratogian, executive editor of the Record of Troy. And actually, we are blessed with Lombardi here because we have her son, David Lombardo. How about that? It is the journalist's Lombardi. That would be the plural, right? David is host of the Capitol Press Room, airing on public radio around the state. Hi, everybody.
Thanks for having us, Rex.
That's a good thing. Actually, we have a lot of topics to get to, but your presence here, David, helps us because, A, you're many years younger than the rest of us in the room, but I want you to talk a little bit about sports news. We sometimes mess up on this because we fail to notice how much sports news matters. It's a huge business. But increasingly, I believe, fans are getting information from sources other than independent media. And there was recently an incident that was a big deal in that regard. You want to explain what that's about?
Well, yeah, and I think this underscores the issue of whether the independent media is even that independent, because there was reporting recently on a traffic accident that the San Francisco 49ers head coach got into, and ultimately it was announced or revealed by the media, seemingly in coordination with the team and its own release, because you had the team coming out with some information about it, and a second later you had a tweet, a second after that you had a whole news story laying out what was happening, and it was clear that this had been done in conjunction between ESPN and the 49ers, and to some degree that makes sense because the NFL owns a share of ESPN, and by extension then the 49ers own a share of ESPN. So it's raised some real concerns about these journalists being maybe too close with the 49ers, but it also made me think about times in my own experience where I've maybe had a story and gone to an outlet, maybe it's the governor's office, maybe it's the legislature, and said, hey, I've got this story and maybe it's not ready, maybe it's not ripe, maybe there's some other ways to explore it, and we've found maybe ways to go deeper into a story. So it raised a whole bunch of different questions for me.
But thinking about sports coverage in particular, Barbara and Judy, you've probably had the experience that I've had where you sometimes wonder, are my sports reporters especially independent? Or are they not cutting their coverage a little bit to please the coaches?
Yes, there definitely is an issue with boosterism. And this gets away from the topic of holding news for sports, which I hope we get back to. But yeah, there would be instances where reporters, especially I think at a small publication, see their job as covering the games, covering the team, maybe writing features about the people who are playing, and they are not covering the things that could also be considered news. It could be budget issues. It could be how players are chosen, even on a high school level, how the tournaments are set up. There could be things that are of interest, what things are costing people and who gets picked and who gets left off. There's stories that could be written that the reporter doesn't consider their job.
Yeah, and boosterism is a good word because I often would think that what they were reporting was what was good for the sport. You also get that a little bit in arts and entertainment coverage. When they cover theater productions or concert reviews, they are promoting the good of the event, the good of the game, the good of the production. The issue about the story being ripe and about the coach accident. I think it was right the day it happened.
Oh, sure.
And I went to look at the local newspaper to see if they reported it, and they didn't as well. You would have thought if that happened here in the Capital District where we're recording from, we would have picked that up unless it was suppressed.
I don't know. People might not be going through those police reports the same way they did 20, 30 years ago, and you don't have people crawling through that and just can go unnoticed.
And you don't have the sources, too, because when a coach is injured in an accident, seriously hurt, then you'd think that people would be talking about it and people that you as a reporter should know, that somebody in that circle would say something.
There's also the social aspect that has changed. My father-in-law was a sports writer and in the 1950s. And the big difference now is that there was a time when the athletes and the sports writers would hang out in the same bars. They were almost of the same social class. And now, of course, athletes are huge celebrities, extraordinarily wealthy, and the teams need them. The journalism outlets need them to be able to talk about what's going on. And so you don't have the access anymore that you used to have when you could. And you know how this is when you're covering politics. You're
at the
state capitol. You hang out with people and you get a little bit of information that way.
But it also makes me think of that transactional nature that you see in politics also happens in sports, where you maybe aren't highlighting the worst nature of an athlete or their bad days, and you're highlighting their good days. And in exchange, maybe they're giving you an interview. Maybe they're going to tell you that they're going to sign with the Philadelphia 76ers on their quest for a championship. But I also think about the regional sports networks, and these are often owned, at least historically, by the teams. And so you might listen to Yankees game and you wouldn't hear anything critical of the team, and you expected that. But coming back to that initial story, you would think of something like ESPN or the local newspapers as being that independent source, that they would have a critical eye, and more, because access is so important, they are loath to do that, especially if you're ESPN and you're looking for sports rights, and the NFL can sell those rights to another network, a network that maybe isn't going to ask those same questions. And then you're going to be thinking about what your coverage is going to be like.
I looked for but did not find an explanation of why they withheld that story.
Huh. Yeah, I don't think anybody has actually answered that question, have they? I think that they would just say, we just had it at that time. Interesting question. Isn't there also a difficulty in determining how far you go with something that might be newsworthy involving an athlete versus what might be prying? There have been a lot of stories, for example, of the mental health of certain athletes. Some athletes have stepped away from the game for a while to get themselves back into shape. This is newsworthy because these athletes command a huge amount of money. They have fans all over the world. So when somebody is needing to take a break, if they're the number one or number two tennis player in the world and they're stepping away from the game for a while, it's newsworthy. But on the other hand, you're stepping into very private area when you talk about the mental health of an athlete. This is tough, I think, figuring out the ethical constraints of what is worth reporting and what goes beyond what's really appropriate.
It's a judgment call, I think, on a case-by-case basis. So the people at ESPN say, okay, we know about this now, and we will hold it until you're ready to make a report on it. And part of the exchange is so that we have the complete story and that we have it first. So that the idea of having a scoop, but it was ridiculous because they obviously had the information well ahead to be able to put together a scoop that comes out seconds after the announcement.
As long as we have someone talking about sports journalism, why do people ask athletes for comment after a game when they absolutely say nothing? The defense put up a good defense, or it's usually meaningless, like these halftime comments. Why do that?
Hey, come on.
It's talking to a politician. They don't say anything.
There are some introspective athletes, though, who will give you a good quote. But yes, then there are others who say, I'm only here because I'm obligated to be here. And that's kind of their recurring answer. Or Greg Popovich, when he coached the Spurs, who would antagonize the sideline reporters and basically call into question
their questions.
Yes, basically. Which was fun in its own right to watch.
Yeah, and maybe we get too carried away with it because it is entertainment after all.
Sure.
Maybe I'm applying too much seriousness to the whole story. But it's really a huge issue that news organizations need to consider as you weigh independence being one of the fundamental tenets of ethical journalism, the independence of your sources, the independence of your organization from your sources.
And when you think about who you're covering on a larger scale, think over the years of the problems that Tiger Woods has had and how those things were covered by the media and sometimes with kid gloves when it maybe was not appropriate.
If you have thoughts on this, folks, we love to hear from you. Media at WAMC.org is how you let us know. Media at WAMC.org. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Barbara and David Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. And because we sit here in a studio in Albany, New York, we are right next door to Vermont. And Governor Phil Scott of Vermont signed an executive order directing state agencies to give preference to local print, digital, and radio and television outlets when placing advertising. Vermont thus becomes the first state to prioritize local news in state contracts. So this is a good idea, right? We can't find anything to pick out on this, can we?
Not me.
If you're trying to maximize state dollars, I would say that public media, potentially to its detriment, has often said, hey, we can be a home for your messaging, and we feel like it's our responsibility to promote what you need to say, and thus we'll do it for free. And there's some sort of maximum about buying the cow when you're giving the milk away. So maybe this runs contrary to the spirit of public media, but again, with skin in the game, would love it if New York had bought some more underwriting opportunities for the Capitol Press Room.
Now, we talked previously on this show about legislation that I believe actually was passed by the state legislature, sponsored by State Senator Pat Fahey of Albany, that would require news organizations to reveal when they have used artificial intelligence in the publication. And I think that we had some people around this table who weren't great fans of that.
Did that get signed?
It hasn't been signed yet, but it's been passed by both houses.
Judy is looking bitter about this. She's not happy.
What a stupid law.
Trying to help us.
They didn't have any hearings about it. It didn't seem like they even thought it through. This is a classic example of an unconstitutional law compelling the press what to do and how to do it, leaving the responsibility for enforcing it to the attorney general, leave it to telling the press what to do. It's so vague as to be meaningless. It's so vague as to be impossible to enforce and not needed. And I can't think of one good reason for it.
Anyone?
Having recorded an interview with the, I think, Writers Guild of America East about this and not trying to carry water for them, because we raised our own concerns about some of the First Amendment compelled speech issues that you just brought up, but they argue that this is a better way to create an informed media consumer so that they have a better sense of what they're looking at, particularly for those bad actors that are heavily reliant on AI for everything from A to Z in creating this type of product. And so maybe this isn't aimed at the Daily Gazette and the Times Union and the Saratogian. It's going to bring them into this fold, and they're going to have to comply with it. But speaking with the champions of it, they feel like this is a way to target some of the bad actors, so to speak.
So we want government to regulate our business, we being whoever passed this law. And it passed very substantially.
Passed easily, yes. Yeah. And probably the governor will sign it. Maybe she'll sign it, as they say, subject to a chapter amendment. That is, to have some definitions put in later after the law gets signed.
Right.
That happens all the time.
I read through it. It's vague and it's unenforceable. And yet it sounds like something that everybody should be in favor of if you just gloss over the highlights of it. But if the target is really bad players, people who should not be allowed to get away with using AI willy-nilly, that's commendable. The idea is commendable, but how do you enforce that?
And just to get to the rationale for this, this is really about protecting jobs in newsrooms and elsewhere, because the idea is that you can shame these outlets into not using AI by requiring them to disclose when they're using it and thus preserving journalism jobs.
That is not realistic at all. No knock on you. But
for all you people in other states listening to this, this is coming for you, too. I'm sure other states will move this. It's feel-good legislation that is inconsequential, except if it gets really enforced, and then it's going to be a real problem. I don't want the state looking over my shoulder, telling me what to write, how to write it, and when to disclose. It's the classic slippery slope.
You guys would have really livened up the assembly floor debate.
Yeah.
That's what made it interesting.
Too bad they didn't have really much of a debate on it.
Now, speaking of the state stepping in, what about this issue? David, you did an interview and reported about a different approach, which is problematic for journalism outlets, the stealth crawlers that grab journalism content. Explain to us what a stealth crawler is.
Yeah, for lack of a better term, this is essentially a bot that is scraping a news website like the Daily Gazette, like the Times Union, and then it's taking that independent, organically produced journalism and then repackaging it on the Schenectady News website and the Albany Times website so that this is going to look like its own organic journalism when in fact it's just repackaged stuff that existed elsewhere. And they're looking to basically stop those people from coming into those websites in the first place.
It's really theft. Let's listen to this. Here's Danielle Coffey, who's president and CEO of the News Media Alliance, talking about stealth crawlers.
By default, you have to identify yourself when you come onto a website, knock on the door, crawl the content. Usually we let everyone in, but sometimes these bots, these nefarious ones, they disguise themselves. And these bad bots come onto our website, they take our stuff, and then they use it, and they've created this third-party market like the Napster used to do. And so none of the good guys do it. None of the ones investing in AI infrastructure here do it. It's really addressing the bad bots, makes them identify themselves. That's it. So that we can just navigate our websites and be able to have some control over what comes and what goes.
Now, understand there is a market for this information that is being seized by these crawlers, and that is people who want to bypass paywalls, right? So they'd grab information produced by legitimate news sources with a paywall that's designed to pay for the journalism, for the reporters who get the information, and make it otherwise available on their own sites, which they can then sell against. They can sell advertising to support that and make money off somebody else's work. So that's why there's a market for this and why this is necessary.
Yeah, I think with the advent of AI, it's very simple to launch a website that you are then harvesting news from other sites, posting it on your website. You have trivial pop-up ads, and this is all a fly-by-night operation that can generate meaningful revenue. But again, when I think about this enforcement, you talked about the other bill being unenforceable. To me, this is reminiscent of some of the efforts to crack down on spam callers that people get. And we have tougher laws, we expand our laws, but they keep popping up. And this is another one where, in the course of our interview, I was curious about how do you actually envision enforcing this? How do you stop a bad actor that's acting off the shores of America? And there wasn't the best answers for that, and I think you could be playing whack-a-mole with us to a certain degree.
Well, I listened to the entire interview on
Thanks,
the
Mom.
Press
room.
Excellent.
Our number one listener.
There you go.
But that definitely came across because you asked that question about the enforceability of it, and it was a whack-a-mole kind of an answer. It's not satisfactory, but it's almost better than nothing. It made me think about how do you define plagiarism, and then how do you go prove that you were plagiarized, and if they're not, does it have to be word for word? If the only source that they used is what you published and they are just summarizing it a little bit more, isn't that still plagiarism?
We used to worry about that in the early days of the internet when you would post a story that you had reported and suddenly it would appear on a local TV newscast an hour later.
What?
Imagine
that's,
that.
That's so hard to believe.
Not to mention radio when they had news on private radio, commercial radio.
But it was really quite remarkable. You work 2 weeks on a story, you finally nail it. And so what the TV news directors, if you called to complain, which I did, would tell you, we confirmed that story. Essentially, their reporter would call up the agency and say, is that story in the Times Union true? Yeah, guess it is. Okay, thank you. And they've got the story.
Yeah, and you've also have the issue of fair use. They just take a piece of it. The law has determined that's fair use. You saw this in the early days of the internet where people would cut and paste your stories and post it on their own little website. This is definitely affecting small local newspapers. I've seen it around here. And the operators of those organizations, they don't have the resources to track everything down and to make the effort to make these things stop. I think the web hosting operations have some control over what is happening here, but
yeah, I'm glad you bring up the resources issue because in this bill, the enforcement mechanism authorizes an aggrieved journalism provider to seek an injunction or to request a subpoena. And the idea that the Saratogian is out there policing this, or even the Times Union, the paper with more resources, it's just hard to believe that anyone's really going to have the time, capacity, or understanding to do something like that.
One of the things that is different these days after the first wave of digital transformation in newsrooms, which some of us in this room lived through, we know how the bottom fell out of newspaper revenue when digital advertising came to replace local print advertising. That essentially was, the print advertising had provided 3/4 of the revenue that most news organizations used to pay for their newsrooms. And a lot of it's gone away. I think there isn't much of a future for advertising-supported media. There still is some of it, but not a lot. Now, there's yet another step. The bottom is falling further because Google is surging by using AI. And instead of sending AI answers, that is, to Google searches, instead of sending people then to the original content, perhaps created by journalists, they are actually giving you an answer generated by AI based upon that content. And the revenue, the advertising revenue of all of these news organizations has fallen significantly. It is a huge threat, further threat to legacy news organizations.
And you highlight this double-edged sword, which is you want to be on Google, you want to be searchable there, but at the same time, you don't want them basically using their AI tools to then look through your reporting and to allow them to circumvent sending people your way by having that AI answer to whatever question people might have had.
When we were editors, Judy and Barbara and I, we spent a lot of time, I'm sure, on SEO, search engine optimization, what we could do to make sure that our content surfaced when people searched a topic. Nowadays, you can't do that because Google is doing something known as self-preferencing. It's shifting ads from the open web to its own properties so that you will never see the content generated by the Times Union. You can do all the SEO you want to. It's not going to show up because Google is directing people just to its own content.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly this has happened. Even a website like Wikipedia is saying that its traffic to Wikipedia is down incredibly because of AI searches, meaning that people don't have to go to Wikipedia for the information that they once relied on that encyclopedia for. I initially saw the story and said, what goes around comes around.
Yeah.
But the impact on news sites will be considerable. It's already started and it will only get worse.
And also what people should be believing and not believing about things that they're seeing. When they do that first search and you don't feel the need to go further, you are finding bad information. I found examples of that just this past week myself, searching for information.
Yeah, you can't necessarily trust it. Folks, beware, but I don't know that there's much that can be done about that unless you break up the great monopolies that are making possible this kind of preferencing. We need to talk today about something that most of our listeners probably have no idea is really a big deal, and that is the Associated Press Stylebook. The AP has just published the 58th edition of the AP Stylebook, and I guess the question now is, does the AP Stylebook matter?
Just back up and tell people, same as I have to tell my students every semester, what is the AP and what is the AP?
The Associated Press is, of course, this international organization of reporters who provide information for news organizations around the world. And their Stylebook has been the guide in capitalization, spelling, terms, all kinds of things. For example, in the new AP Stylebook, healthcare is one word. Now, that may not seem like a big deal to you, but this kind of stuff used to matter to us when our editors were paying attention at the copy desk. And now, with the new edition, I'm just not sure that any of this stuff is going to make much of a difference.
So I have no schooling in AP style at all. I never took a journalism class. And actually, when I was a reporter for Judy, what I used to do when there was anything I was unsure about, I would call up Barb Lombardo and hey, mom, when do I capitalize president? Is it only if there's a name after it? What if I'm just referring to the president more broadly?
That's a great example because that changed in the AP style book over the years that we were working. So there you go, on second reference.
Anybody can buy an AP style book. They're available at bookstores or available online. I always thought they were fascinating reads, give you a lot of information. And oftentimes, newsrooms will have an additional style book to, for example, say how they pronounce a certain word or how they spell a certain town. AP has also set the tone for a lot of news organizations in terms of how they handle controversial issues. Think about the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf of America. They stood up for the Gulf of Mexico. Also, labeling things. They were the leaders. It's one of the reasons you won't see the term illegal aliens in a lot of conventional newspapers because they explained at one point that it was an incorrect way of referring to people in this country without the proper documentation. They deal with issues of gender in a comprehensive way. news organizations aren't required to file AP style, but it certainly gives editors a way of handling some guidance when it comes to handling difficult issues. And also, it's a good way for young journalists to know whether or not to use Mr. and Mrs.
And is black capitalized or not, which is a local decision, for as an example, but you can choose to follow or not follow what AP is doing. I think it all just boils down very simply to consistency. And the main thing that provides is consistency. So within your publication, if you have one story here where AM or PM, that they are lowercase with periods, or just the same way of presenting the information throughout your story. And the key takeaway is not to memorize the style book as I did when I was a journalism student, but just to know that there's more than one way to present something, to look it up, and whatever your publication style is, be familiar with that and check it and just make sure you're being consistent.
Or over one way to do that now.
Oh my God, more than and over. I have not gotten over that change.
Yeah. Ratio and margin, they explain that very well. And one of the things in the new style book is the fact that they're in. For people like J.D. Vance, they're getting rid of the periods between J and the D.
Never have done that. Oh, my goodness. The revolution is at hand, folks. What can you do? All right. We are out of time. That is the Media Project for this week. What do you know? How about that?
I wanted more then, but now it's over.
Bada boom, folks. Okay. Barbara Lombardo and David Lombardo were here. Judy Patrick has joined us. I'm Rex Smith with our producer, David Gustina, here in Studio D. Thanks for joining us. We hope to see you next week once again on The Media Project.
Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the flow.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith. Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Circulation, ting-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.